or visit will.illinois.edu/Illinois Radio Reader for more information. The Illinois Radio Reader is a service of Illinois Public Media.
I'm Celeste Headley, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. We start today with a situation that's captured the attention of the international community. I'm talking about the kidnapping of more than 200 girls at a Nigerian boarding school a few weeks ago. A militant Muslim terrorist group, Boko Haram, has claimed responsibility for the kidnappings. Earlier this week, we talked about the growing pressure from activists and leaders in the Nigerian government to do more to find the girls. And this is bad timing for Nigeria, since the World Economic Forum is now taking place in the country's capital. Here to tell us more about these updates and what could be at stake for Nigeria's economic future is BBC correspondent Tommy Oladipo. He's in Abuja. Tommy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What is the latest update on this situation? I understand the United States is offering aid. Are there any other countries that might step in?
There's a lot of help coming in from around the world. The UK, China, France, and a few other nations are offering support, mostly intelligence, in terms of helping, survey the area and try to find the girls. There isn't much in terms of people actually sending troops down to the area, but a lot of the support is coming in terms of logistics and helping to empower the Nigerian authorities to find these girls.
Although I understand there's a push to label Boko Haram as having an association with Al-Qaeda, which would, of course, involve some kind of military response eventually, right?
Certainly, but so far I don't think that has been established formally to say that Boko Haram and Al-Qaeda are directly linked. Of course, they have very similar ideologies, but at the same time we cannot prove to say what the links are, if there are any, between them.
Abuja has been basically shut down for the World Economic Forum. Is this a topic of discussion among people who've gathered there?
Certainly. I mean, there are lots of Nigerians, in fact, here in Abuja, who are carrying out protests, similar protests you must have seen elsewhere, including in Washington and elsewhere in the U.S. and around the world. There are those protests happening here every day. So people are talking about this. People are asking why the Nigerian government, for starters, did not take this issue seriously until this pressure came from around the world.
And what's the answer to that? Do we know why the Nigerian government seemingly did not put a lot of effort into finding these girls?
Well, the Nigerian government, I mean, we have to look at this holistically, not just about the girls. This Boko Haram crisis has been going on for, 4 to 5 years right now, and the Nigerian government has declared a state of emergency in some parts of the country which are affected by the violence, but there's not much to be seen about the effects of this. And so it's the issue of the kidnapping of this girl that has brought this into the limelight and has put extra pressure on the government. And a lot of people are saying, what if the world didn't speak out? What would have happened? Would the government have kept quiet? The government has defended itself and said, these are issues of terror are certainly new to the country, and it's only just trying to get to grips with it. But at the same time, it claims it's winning the war, but, the signs are not evident.
Boko Haram also operates in neighboring countries as well. What does the African community and the leaders in other African countries have to say about the situation?
Well, of course, there is widespread condemnation of the Boko Haram situation, the Boko Haram insecurity and the killings and the kidnappings by all these countries. Nigeria borders Niger, Chad, and Cameroon, at least from that end of things. And those countries have been, speaking out again and also condemning the violence, but they're not as widely as affected by the problem as Nigeria is. Niger, for example, which is just north of Nigeria, has a U.S. base, and it's possible that, a lot of speculation that there could be drones used from there, U.S. drones that could come into Nigeria and help in the search.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the search for more than 200 girls who were kidnapped at a Nigerian boarding school, and we're speaking with BBC correspondent Tommy Oladipo. He is in Abuja right now. I said more than 200 girls, but as I understand, perhaps as many as 50 of them actually escaped and have made it back to safety. Is that accurate?
That is correct. And we've been speaking to people who've spoken to these girls, and they've been telling their stories about how they escaped. They didn't all escape as a big group. They escaped in small groups. Some of them, while they were being taken away from their town, others escaped from the camp where they had been taken to. And they're, telling the stories of the way they were treated and, the stories they were told that if their families came to rescue them, they would be killed. So those are, some of the stories we're hearing. But apart from those 50, there's still, many more there. And apart from this large group that was kidnapped about 3 weeks ago, these kidnappings have been going on for a long time now in much smaller groups. But I believe this large group is what brought this to the limelight.
Tell me about the leader of Boko Haram, because I understand he came into power in, say, 2009 when the founder of the group was killed. And correct me if I'm wrong, but that's really when Boko Haram's strategies took a much more violent and almost terrorist-like turn.
Boko Haram has been operating as a radical sect in the northeastern city of Maiduguri. And, there was a lot of concern about the radical preachings of a man called Muhammad Yusuf. Now, there's a bit of complication. I wouldn't go into it because the story is a bit complicated, but Muhammad Yusuf was arrested by the military, by the army, and handed over to the police. And somehow, while he was in police custody, he was killed. And from then was when the violence began to escalate, and that was 2009. And since then, it's just been going on and seems to have no end in sight.
And what kind of danger does this pose to the stability of the government?
Well, Boko Haram is determined to overthrow the government. That's what they say they want to do. But so far, they're only in the northeast of the country. But clearly, the violence cannot be ignored. And that's what the Nigerian government has been forced to admit, that the problems are bigger than they make them sound. So what happens now is that the Nigerian government is having to admit that it needs support from elsewhere in the world. And that's where the U.S. and the U.K. and all these other world powers come in, because this problem could escalate. If you look in the northeast in particular, these places are very poor. There's massive unemployment there. And so it's very easy for these radical sects to call people and pay them to carry out attacks for them. So that is where Nigeria finds itself today.
And what exactly is at stake for the Nigerian government economically? Obviously, this was supposed to be a point of pride, the fact that the World Economic Forum was being held in Abuja. Clearly, it's an oil-rich country. And yet, they now have world leaders saying that there's an economic danger, that they would be loath to invest, perhaps, in Nigeria because of the danger from Boko Haram.
Certainly. And Nigeria has just been named as well as Africa's top economy. So there is a lot on offer. There are a lot of opportunities for investment, for business. But which investors would want to come into a country where they don't feel safe? And that is the problem right now. And so, but the Nigerian government has for a long time been trying to divert people's attention from the ongoing insurgency and telling them, you can come to the rest of the country and invest and carry on. But as the violence spreads, for example, here in the capital, Abuja, there have been two bombs since April that have hit this capital. So if people cannot feel safe in the capital city on its own, then, a lot of people would wonder, why should they come in the first place?
So what is the response of the Nigerian people? I've seen all the coverage of the protests. I've seen the women and men marching in the street carrying signs demanding that the government bring back their girls. But in terms of specific demands in the Nigerian government, what happens after this crisis is over?
Well, that's a difficult one, because for many years Nigerians have been disappointed by their government. Their government have failed to deliver on promises, and Nigerians have grown to live and exist without their government. In Nigeria you live, you provide yourself your own electricity, your own water, your own security. And to be honest, from what I've seen, I don't think many Nigerians will be looking to the government for anything beyond just preventing these kinds of major tragic incidents from happening and coming to them.
There's a large portion of, say, British people and foreigners who live, especially in the southern part of Nigeria. Are they basically safe from all of this turmoil?
Well, I mean, if you go to the major centers like Lagos, which is in the south, Lagos is bustling, it's growing, there's so much going on. A lot of the large global financial companies and banks and all of them are moving into Lagos. So yes, there is a lot if you say you want to avoid the violence. But at the same time, a lot of people feel, for how long will the south of Nigeria remain safe, because the south is going through the same thing the north is going through. It's the same unemployment, it's the same underdevelopment, so how long will this fester? Will it possibly might not be in the form of Islamist extremism, it could be in form of something else. Not too long ago we had the Niger Delta militants who were terrorizing the oil-rich Niger Delta, and they used to kidnap oil workers. That happened for many years. So it could be a cycle that just comes up in different forms.
Well, let's bring it back to the girls right before we end here. Tommy, what do we know about what Boko Haram does with these girls? It's been posited that perhaps they're going to put them into the sex trade. They could be killed. How have other girls or even young boys been treated when they've been captured by this group?
Well, unfortunately, there have not been many stories about that. By that, I mean that there have not been many stories of these people kidnapped who have come back to be able to tell what happened to them. So we can't really, I mean, all we can just do is speculate about what happens to them. It is possible, as Boko Haram said, that they will be sold off to be married to people across the borders, across in Chad and Cameroon. They could be taken there. Obviously, people marrying them might not even know that these people have been kidnapped and brought in this form. So it's not exactly clear the fate of these girls as we speak, but it's certainly not looking good.
Tommy Oladipo is in Abuja. He's a BBC correspondent there. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Just ahead, growing up in a family of Bahraini activists, Maryam Al-Khawaja questioned the suffering they put themselves through. Then the Arab Spring began.
I feel like I do have much more of an understanding of why we do what we do now after witnessing the revolutions.
The new film We Are the Giant tells her story and the stories of other young people who helped drive the Arab Revolution. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Celeste Headlee.
Your days are busy.
Work, school, errands, kids.
It never stops.
And the news never stops either.
You can keep up between Morning Edition and All Things Considered with Here and Now. Hi, it's Robin Young.
And Jeremy Hobson. Here and Now brings you breaking news, developing stories, the latest in the arts and innovation.
Asking tough questions, unpacking complex issues.
From across the country and around the world.
Join us.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580. Support for today's broadcast comes from Trophy Time in Champaign. Trophy Time features a variety of items that are organic, recycled, or biodegradable, like calendars, shopping bags, and water bottles. More information can be found at trophytime.com. Trophy Time, they're more than just trophies.
I'm Celeste Headlee, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Jet Magazine announced yesterday it will stop publishing its print edition and go all digital. The magazine has documented African American news and culture for more than 60 years. It became a staple on many black families' coffee tables and in barbershops and beauty parlors. For more, we turn to Richard Prince. He writes Journalisms. It's an online publication about diversity in the media. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you.
You know, we asked our Twitter followers if they're going to miss Jet Magazine, and we got journalist Gwen Eiffel to respond. She said, "What will I read in the shop?" Author Joshua Dubois tweeted, "My grandma Katie in Nashville will lose her mind. There have been stacks of jets in her bathroom since Reconstruction. So what about you? Is this something, a print edition at least, that you're going to miss?
Well, I have not read Jet in the print edition for quite a while, but it's been in my consciousness. I think if all those people who say that they read Jet faithfully were actually reading it, they would have said something before now, because the frequency of the publication was knocked down to every 2 weeks and then every 3 weeks without a peep really from the public. So I think this move was really something that had to happen. They had to do something, because the times have changed and sort of left Jet behind.
It could mean, of course, that this is a chance for Jet to expand. It could also mean that Jet isn't turning a profit. We spoke earlier to Cheryl Mayberry McKissick. She's the COO and president of digital for Jet's parent company, Johnson Publishing. And here's what she said about why the founder, John Johnson, named it Jet back in 1951.
He saw a change in the habits of consumers and people who wanted to procure their news and information in a faster manner. And so that's why he called it Jet. And it really seemed to talk to us in the sense that that's exactly the situation that we felt that we were in today. People want to get their information wherever they are, okay? And advertisers are interested in having more of an interactive relationship with the consumer.
That almost sounds like they're really planning to expand the magazine. What's your response?
I think that's something they have to do. They have to try something. But I have to also say that there are a lot of people who are not very optimistic about this move. I talked to one of them who was a magazine expert called Samir, who's known as Mr. Magazine. He calls it a sad, sad day for the black press in America. Digital is more like the new life support for the magazine. Soon they will pull the plug and nobody will notice. Out of sight, out of mind. If they thought they can't survive in print, but they can on digital, they must think again. It's a jungle out there, and for folks and advertisers to follow them there, it's one of those pipe dreams.
You know, Jet holds a very sentimental place for people of the older generation because of the role it played in covering the civil rights movement. What did Jet become known for, and how did it become such a big component of the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s?
Well, it was a big component of the civil rights movement, and the photographs of Emmett Till, his disfigured body in that casket, played
That's
a
the young
role.
Man that was murdered for
exactly.
Allegedly looking at
in
a white
Mississippi, exactly. But to truth be told, it was also known for the beauty of the week. It was known for listing every black person who was on television back in the days. It may be hard for young people to remember this, but there was a time when it was rare to see black people on television, and Jet had a special page right near the back that would list all the black people who were on television that week. That eventually disappeared, but that's where you could go to look at that. And also, and this is very important, it was a place if you were getting married or had an anniversary and you wanted black America to know about it, it would be listed in that social section.
If it wasn't in Jet, it didn't happen.
There you go. There you go. So, yes, they did the civil rights things, but it was also sort of a glue for the black community nationally that has sort of disappeared as we have more and more media outlets and as the mainstream media have accommodated and become a little more inclusive.
How well can Jet then appeal to the younger audience? African Americans do tend to get their news and information on mobile, either mobile phones, tablets, or some kind of mobile device. But how well can Jet make that transition from kind of something that holds a sentimental place to something that people go to for breaking news?
Jet is already online in mobile configuration, and the publishers are very happy with the way that is now. If they keep that up and if they are timely, and that's very important, being timely, because you know we are in a 24/7 news cycle, even with the celebrity stuff that Jet is now pushing, you know, they can compete.
So, I mean, Richard Prince, you write about diversity in the media, so I have to kind of ask this bigger question.
Yes.
Is there a bigger meaning to this about black publications and minority publications, or is this just a business story?
No, it is something bigger. It's part of our history. And there are still things, I think, that one of the appeals of Jet is you would pick it up, and there's always something you didn't see anywhere else or that you didn't know, you hadn't heard about. And I think that will continue, and that's the kind of thing, that's the reason why we have a black press, including Jet.
Richard Prince writes Journalisms. It's an online publication about diversity issues in the media. He joined us from his home in Virginia. Thanks so much, Richard.
Thanks so much.
Now, it's been more than 3 years since a wave of protests took hold, first in Tunisia and then all across the Arab world. A new documentary looks at the young people who made the sacrifices to push for regime change in places like Libya, Syria, and Bahrain during the Arab Spring. People like Bahraini Zainab Al-Khawaja.
For centuries, a lot of Arabs have been feeling that no matter what I do, nothing's going to change in this country. And that's why I can't quit. I can't give up. I've been arrested maybe 7 times, I think. And I have more than 13 cases against me in court. I do feel guilty when I leave my daughter. They're very, very tough choices. And a lot of times I tend to choose being an activist over being a mother or being a wife or being a daughter.
Zainab's sister Maryam is also featured in the film We Are the Giant. She joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
And also with us is the film's co-producer, Razan Galiouni. Welcome to the program as well, Razan.
Thank you.
Maryam, the title of the film actually comes from something your father told you and your sister when you were very young. What was that?
When we were growing up, of course, we grew up in a very activist environment. And my father would always ask us questions without giving us an answer to make us think about things more critically. And so one of the things he told us as children was, you know, people are like this great big giant, and the governments are like this very, very tiny man. Why is it that the giant will bow down to this tiny man? And we would always be thinking, well, yeah, why is it that, you know, a giant of that magnitude would actually allow himself to be controlled and in fear of this very small man, which is the government? And that was where the title of the movie came from, is that the people are the giant and the governments in comparison are very tiny.
And yet, Razan, your documentary shows very often why it is that the giant bows down to the little guy, right? I mean, what we see is, in some cases, some very violent reactions from a government which may be small but has armed forces at its hands. Why did you focus on Syria, Libya, and Bahrain?
We actually started off filming in more than just those three countries. And over time, while we watched the various revolutions change and we witnessed the ways the sort of legacy media outlets were covering the stories, we all decided to pick stories that weren't being told, actually, as much as other ones. So Bahrain obviously has been nicknamed, and I'm sure Maryam has comments about this, the forgotten revolution. Syria was very important to us because the Syrian revolution has been largely presented as a violent uprising, and it really did begin nonviolently and was a very organic revolution. And we really, you know, wanted to show that story and have that narrative be documented because so few people have. And then Libya, of course, is a very incredibly important sort of cautionary tale. So Greg, Julie, John, myself, Josh sat together and kind of thought that this pairing of these three would represent the revolutions in a way that haven't been represented.
Maryam, it's very difficult for me in my comfortable home here in the United States to imagine being put in the kind of position to make the decisions that you've made. You and your family, through multiple arrests, through beatings, I mean, your father was tortured. And I wonder, when you're weighing personal safety, not just personal safety, but your entire family's safety, how you decide that that calculation is still worth it? I mean, especially seeing what's happened in Syria, how do you still keep moving forward?
Well, I mean, I think to some extent it's because we grew up with that kind of mindset. I mean, my father has been through so much. I remember from 2001 until 2011, I saw my father coming home numerous times with marks of beatings on his back. I always pose the same question to him, is why do you continue doing what you're doing when the outcome is not what you want it to be? And he always told me, someday you'll understand. And I feel like I do have much more of an understanding of why we do what we do now after witnessing the revolutions. And not just the Bahraini one, but in general, you know, whether we're talking about Yemen, Egypt, Syria, Libya, Tunisia, and others, is that if people are willing to continue to take to the streets and facing the guns, of course we have to continue going. Those people deserve not only our respect and solidarity, but also for us to work for a better tomorrow for everyone. But I think, you know, I can explain it with one simple example of why we do what we do. When the Bahrain Center for Human Rights, which I'm the acting president for, we decided to do a campaign on ending impunity in Bahrain. And what we did was we publicized pictures and names of people that we had identified as being responsible for grave human rights violations. I was very worried that because I'm not in Bahrain and the government can't punish me for the campaign, that they would go after especially my sister and my father. And so I called up my mother and she said, we did not go through what we did so that we can now start being afraid of the consequences. And she said, you do what you think is right for the people of Bahrain and for our cause, no matter the consequences.
I just wanted to actually play another clip from the film in which you're talking about this very issue and in terms of reporting human rights abuses in Bahrain.
He started explaining this case to me where we received information from a very trusted source that this man had been tortured so badly that his face was unrecognizable. He talked about how he had been tortured psychologically, physically, but also sexually. And I kept thinking, I was like, who could this be? Like, this case is very, very severe. And then he told me at the end, and write that it's Abdelhadi Al-Khwaja. It was my father being beaten.
When you found that out, when you found out this severe case of being beaten beyond recognition was your father, there must have been a moment, I assume, when you thought, I have to stop.
No, I mean, I never got to the point of thinking I have to stop. And I think, you know, this is the same poor judgment on part of the governments that they thought doing these things will push people to think we have to stop. But it actually has the opposite effect. It has an effect of, no, we must continue because this is the outcome, because these are the consequences, we must continue. And of course, it was very difficult, not just finding out that my father had been tortured, but reading the details of how he was sexually assaulted by the police during his torture. I think that was the most difficult part. But I had to find strength within myself to be able to do the job that I need to do as a human rights defender and to put my emotions aside so that I can do the job.
Razan, someone else that you feature in the film in Libya actually gave his life to the revolution. A 21-year-old American, Mohamed Ben Sadek, left his home in Virginia and decided to fight with the rebels there in Libya. And here is a piece of his story told by his father, Osama. Take a listen.
I knew that my son, he did to save this country. He didn't want nothing out of it. And when they heard about his story, American citizen, young, you know, smart, handsome, and having all the opportunity to be out of Libya, he decided to stay and fight.
Razan, I wonder what you learned about people's motivations. Seeing the sacrifices that people made, in Osama's case, losing his son, what did you think about what keeps people in this struggle and what motivates them?
Oh, it's like, that's such a tough question because you meet all these amazing people and I have no idea where they find this kind of willpower and strength. People like Maryam and Zainab and Muhannad and Ghassan and Mataz, who are all in the film, are just, I think they're driven by the universal concept of living a life of self-dignity, not just for themselves, but for the people that they love and their countrymen. And I think it was, to me, it was just something wonderful. It was a beautiful, like, sort of camaraderie. And I think when you go and you talk to these people that are revolutionaries, you see that what's driving them is love and very beautiful things. It's not power-driven. It's not about politics. It's really just about having a better life for your children, supporting the people that you love, and building a country that you're proud of.
And one of the things that we kind of come away with in the film's portrayal of Syria is that neither armed revolution or peaceful revolution is working there either. What did you take away from your time filming in Syria? And I understand you had to do some of this filming in secret. There's one shot where it looks like the cameraman almost gets hit by an explosive device. But what did you learn? There seems to be regret at how that revolution has gone.
Well, the Syrian revolution is a very sad story because it did begin nonviolently, and it was definitely one of the most pure revolutions to begin. It was started by nonviolent activists in the suburbs of Damascus, and they went for about 11 months, I would say, nonviolently, and then slowly became armed with the FSA.
It's the Free Syrian Army.
Yes, the Free Syrian Army. The foreign fighters came in, and then it became sort of a three-way battle between these foreign fighters, the nonviolent revolutionaries, and the regime. And it's obviously a very sad story, but I don't think it's right to say that the revolution has failed, because the revolution belongs to them, and they say it's still there. So I think that it's our job to kind of respect that and sort of help them find a place to be heard, which is why they're in the film.
Well, Maryam, let me ask you about the Arab Spring as a whole, because I've read commentaries of people saying, wow, look, the Arab Spring, we thought it was going to be this massive wave of change, and yet, you know, it's turned out to really fizzle out in many places, or turn out not as well as we'd hoped. What do you say to people who say they're disappointed in the Arab Spring?
Well, I think, you know, it's easy to become disappointed and pessimistic about what's going on and the way that things have developed. But also, if we look at world history, we'll see that it's something that is actually very realistic. I mean, how long did it take for the French Revolution to actually turn into a democracy?
Even the American Revolution, actually, there was about 11 years between the end of the Revolutionary War and our Constitution.
Exactly. So I think it's a progress. And I think that the way that we're headed only makes sense that it happened the way that it did. Whether we're looking at the military control in Egypt or the way that things are going in Syria and so on. But what we have to remember is that if we stop now, what we go back to is something worse than what we started with in 2011.
Maryam Al-Khawaja is a human rights activist from Bahrain. Rizan Galini is a Palestinian-American documentary filmmaker who co-produced We Are the Giant. They joined us from our bureau in New York. The film is being shown at festivals now. It's slated for general release in the fall. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, before his Rat Pack fame, Sammy Davis Jr. got his start in vaudeville at only 3 years old. He was billed as a 40-year-old midget.
No one could believe that someone that small and that young would be that talented.
His daughter Tracy shares her father's stories in a new book, Sammy Davis Jr., A Personal Journey with My Father. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Celeste Headlee.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Pajamagram Company, offering women's pajamas in gift packaging delivered overnight and for Mother's Day at pajamagram.com. From Inada, maker of the DreamWave massage chair with body scanning technology and shiatsu point detection. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. From Cancer Treatment Centers of America, combining conventional and integrative therapies to help maintain quality of life during treatment at cancercenter.com. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
As New Yorker cartoonist Roz Chast's parents aged, they really resisted talking about end-of-life issues.
We were all going to have to deal with this aging thing. And there's a drawing of me standing a little bit behind my parents on the moving sidewalk of life.
Her new graphic memoir is called Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? Roz Chast on the next Fresh Air.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
This October, come aboard WILL's American History Train. We'll travel in private rail cars restored to their 1950s glory. Our private chef will serve delicious onboard meals as we travel to Boston, Washington, D.C., and Philadelphia for stops at historic sites, museums, and battlefields on this 10-day trip. For more information, call 217-333-7300 or visit will.illinois.edu/willtravel.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Friends of WILL and from Urbana's Market at the Square, happening every Saturday morning, rain or shine, from 7 a.m. to noon at the corner of Illinois and Vine Streets in historic downtown Urbana. Learn more at urbanaillinois.us/market.
I'm Celeste Headlee, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. We turn now to a new book about the only black Puerto Rican one-eyed Jewish entertainer in the world. That's how Sammy Davis Jr. used to describe himself. His daughter Tracy shares that detail in her new book, Sammy Davis Jr., A Personal Journey with My Father. It's based on conversations the two had as he battled with throat cancer toward the end of his life. Through stories and a lot of photos, it captures the extraordinary life of one of the original members of the Rat Pack.
This is my moment, my once in a lifetime, when I can explore a new and exciting land. For once in my lifetime, I feel like a giant.
It's a life that spanned six decades and included nearly 50 albums, seven Broadway shows, 23 films, and countless stage performances. Tracy Davis joins us now to talk more about that. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
In the introduction, you write, I wanted to revisit my father's life with the grace of time having passed and emotions calmed down to put everything in perspective. It was very interesting to me, your descriptions of his early life growing up in Harlem. And he didn't go to school. He was working as a three-year-old on stage with your grandfather. And the effect that must have had on him is just, even in his early developing years, always working.
He didn't have the traditional family life. He was always working, 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 and trying to become famous. And then once he was famous, especially in the 60s and 50s, before black people could vote, he was scared that it could be taken away at any minute. So he never had that feeling of being able to relax at home. It wasn't until much later, when he was very well established, that he felt like he could take time off.
Tell me the story, if you would, of how they avoided the laws that were meant to keep very young kids off the stage.
My grandfather was doing a black version of vaudeville. And number one, I don't think people cared that much about, you know, small black children, but they billed him as a midget. And they got away with it because no one could believe that someone that small and that young would be that talented.
And he had to wear blackface.
Yes, he did. There's a picture in the book where he's little and he's wearing it, and it just makes me sad. But that's what they did.
I wanted to talk about the song Bojangles. I mean, this is a song that he sang his whole life, and I think he ended most of his concerts with it. And it sounded in the book as though you'd never really known before these conversations what his attachment to that song was. Let's take a listen to a piece of the song first.
I knew a man, Bojangles, and he danced for you. In worn-out shoes, with silver hair, a ragged shirt, and baggy pants. He would do the old soft shoe.
Now, this song is not about the historical, the real Bill Bojangles. It's about somebody else. But your father described it as having a love-hate relationship with the song. What did he mean?
Well, it became a signature classic song for him. And he would, almost every show, end it with that. And people were disappointed if he didn't sing it. He sings it so well because they're not just lyrics for Dad. It really tells a story. He was always afraid that he would end up like that person. That's what was in his heart sometimes. It's like, I don't want to end up like the person in this song. And he thought for a very long time that he would end up like that.
Tell me about his time in the military as well. And obviously, at this point, we're still talking about things that happened before you were born. But there were some really moving stories about not only the racism and the physical violence he faced from his fellow soldiers, but also a man, Sergeant Williams, who really kind of looked out for him and protected him and went above and beyond.
Yeah, as Dad said, sometimes you find real good and real horrible situations. And I know how rough it was for him and how brutally ugly people could be. But then, like you said, there's people that will protect you. He could always sing and entertain, but he learned how to read in the Army. And that was a big deal because he really didn't know how to read.
Sergeant Williams was one of the men that he was thinking of when he talked about the fact that all the way along, despite terrible racism that he encountered his whole life, there were often white men and women who stepped forward to help him out. And also, one of the major ones was Frank Sinatra, with whom he had a lifelong friendship.
Yes, especially Uncle Frank. He did more for Dad than anybody because he knew of Dad, and Dad went to go see him perform, and they wouldn't let him in. And that was one of the first times he said, you either let him in and put a table down front for him, And that kind of really was what cemented the friendship. And Frank was the biggest star in the world. And I think Dad was grateful for that his whole life.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Tracy Davis. She's the daughter of the great Sammy Davis Jr., and her new book is called Sammy Davis Jr., A Personal Journey with My Father. Well, obviously, one of the reasons the Rat Pack was so successful was the rapport between your father and Frank Sinatra. Let's take a listen.
I start off by having you meet Mr. Frank Sinatra. When somebody loves you, it's no good unless she loves you.
Boy, if you like him, you're going to be wild about me.
I mean, Frank Sinatra was also the best man at your father's wedding to your mother. And many people may remember what a stir that caused because of this interracial marriage at the time. They postponed their own wedding until after the election at which JFK won the presidency because Frank Sinatra was going to be the best man, and Frank Sinatra was very closely aligned with JFK's campaign, correct?
Well, first of all, when my mom and dad were dating, Frank was pretending that, you know, mom was his date. That's how they kind of got around, is that mom was his date, not my dad's. And if my mom went to go stay at a hotel, she would stay on one floor and my dad would stay on another floor. And then at night, they'd go stay together and then separate early enough to go back to their respective rooms. And let me just put it this way. I think that my dad was overjoyed that he stood up for them at the wedding. It meant a lot. Then, you know, it became a thing with my father because after all the campaigning and all the work he did and everything like that, he wasn't invited to the inaugural. And I think that really, Dad never got over that. He really felt slighted.
How was it for you then growing up in an interracial family? All the racism that your father went through, and much of it is detailed in the book, and it's frankly very painful. How much did that touch you as a child?
A lot. You'd come out sometimes and there was times that a swastika was painted somewhere or the N-word was written on a car or a windshield or something like that. But they did make a pretty good cocoon for us when we were really little because most of their friends were in show business or music where there was less racism in that because if you had talent, then it didn't really matter. If you could play an instrument or do something or be a good singer or a good actor, they really didn't care. So it kind of gave me a little bit of a false sense of security, and that's probably a good thing because otherwise I probably would have been more introverted than I actually am.
I wonder if you'd recount what your father had to say about the African-American community. He was obviously upset that some blacks were angry with him. Some blacks called him an Uncle Tom and claimed that he'd sold out in order to please the white community and sell more albums to white people. What was his response to that?
Well, he was hurt, but I don't think that that's anything new for black artists even today. When you get to a certain level, you kind of have to grow your circle. And I think for the black community at that time, they wanted to have a piece of Sammy Davis Jr., and they didn't really understand that he was giving as much as he could give, and it somehow it just didn't seem good enough. You know, to be called names by your own folks is really hurtful because then where do you go when times are tough, when your own community, a lot of people don't think that you're part of that community anymore? It's a little scary.
And in light of that, it was especially touching when you were talking about your father's 60th anniversary TV special. And Michael Jackson performed the song You Were There. That's a song that Jackson wrote especially for your father,
mm-hmm.
about the way that he broke down barriers for musicians, especially of color. Let's take a listen to that song.
You took the hurt. You took the shame. They built the walls to block your way. You beat them down. You won the day. It wasn't right. It wasn't fair. You taught them all made them care. Yes, you were there, and thanks to you, there's now a door we all walk through.
I mean, I gotta say, having read your book, that song even now makes me all verklempt. What was what was your dad's reaction, and yours also?
Well, I think that Michael really loved my father, and he would sneak sometimes to Dad's shows and sit on an apple box and on the side of the stage and watch him perform. And Dad would say, "What are you doing?" He goes, "I'm just going to steal some of your moves." And he's like, "Okay, you know, because that's what entertainers say all the time. I'm just going to steal some steps." And if anybody has seen that show, if you look at the outpouring of love between the two, if you see my dad's face. Because Michael came out to do that just for him and wrote it just for him. And he didn't really, he's not known as a guy that does television specials. So it was really moving for Dad. And it was moving for me, too. He's just really respectful of my dad. And I always appreciated that.
So your father said to you during these conversations, "Just don't let me die here."
Yes.
What did that mean to you?
What it meant was keep me alive. Not only in your heart or in our family, but he wanted to have a legacy. He wanted to be remembered and thought about. I have these memories, and I cherish them, and I've ran into so many people, and I still do now when they find out who Dad is, and they'll start asking me questions and whatever, and that makes me feel good that he's still remembered.
So during the whole book, it was a question of whether or not your father would make it long enough to see the birth of his first grandchild. And he did.
Yes.
I wonder now, with your children all these years later, after, as you say, with the grace of time, what is it that you most want to pass on to your family about what you learned from your father?
I think that one of the things I learned from Dad is that even though he went through all those tough racism times and everything, hatred fades and you bring it up to talk about it. So hopefully you change somebody's mind. Maybe you won't. But maybe they'll take a softer stance. And what I try and teach my kids is the patience that Dad had for the world, but also the love that he had for people, for his job, for his family, and that he didn't, you know, I'm living in the South right now, and sometimes there's still incidents that come up, and you just say to yourself, "Hello, 2014, and people don't understand that it's still there, so... You know, every once in a while, there's still a little fight left in me, and I try and teach my kids that.
Tracy Davis's book about her father is called Sammy Davis Jr., A Personal Journey with My Father. It's out this month. Tracy Davis joined us from a studio in her hometown of Nashville, Tennessee. Tracy, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Now we're going to talk to another daughter of a musical legend. Brazilian singer Maria Rita has 7 Latin Grammys to her name. Not a surprise, considering she's the daughter of superstar songstress Elis Regina. Maria stopped by recently, and we asked her to tell us what music gives her comfort at home and on the road.
Hello, everyone. This is Maria Rita, and this is what's been playing in my ear.
Que surpresa, beleza.
I listen to Caetano Veloso, who's a Brazilian songwriter and singer, who's had pretty long history and an incredible dedication to Brazilian music. And one of my favorite songs is called Surpresa, means surprise. And in the song, he's talking about how his love interest has just arrived and all these wonderful, beautiful things that he's imagining with that person. I got a little shy now. I've also been listening to Daft Punk. I completely fell in love with their last album. One of my favorite songs is Lose Yourself to Dance. It's just catchy. Another Brazilian songwriter that I really enjoy listening to is Gonzaguinha, and one of my favorite songs
is Espere por mim, Morena.
Espere por mim, Morena. Espere que eu chego já. O amor por você, Morena.
Espere por mim, Morena. Is wait for me, Morena. Morena is an endearment way of referring to someone. And he's leaving and going on the road, and so he's asking kindly and lovingly to this woman, wait for me.
Morena, faz a saudade me apressar.
Just reminds me of the moment that my one-year-old daughter was born and that I just completely fell in love with her. And I relate to the song because I travel a lot too, just like he does, and that's what he talks about in the music. Also, been listening to Justin Timberlake.
Hey, little mama, I gotta ask me if I want to.
Love listening to Pusher Love Girl, so I admire his talent for quite a long time. He's a great singer, a great performer, great dancer, and just relate to the dedication and the love for music.
That was Brazilian singer Maria Rita telling us what's playing in her ear. To hear our previous conversation with her, head over to npr.org/tellmemore. And that's our program for today. I'm Celeste Headlee, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Tune in for more talk tomorrow.